inhabit this land. This people that I love, forget this land of windswept hills, of yellow gauze, of thorn, of flaming flowers, the jeweled throne of sovereign kings, can shrine the rich a sweeter nation's ships have proudly sailed to burn, to ravage these far shores. The Romans' glory's warded tales, the Saxons bled upon these moors. Unheeding time has seen them come, their glory past death bring them low, and many who fought became as we, sons of the
Welcome to The Melodic Line, the official podcast of the George Lloyd Society. My name is Peter Davison, and you've just been listening to an extract from George Lloyd's opera Jähnen, specifically Geraint's aria in Act 1. Geraint is a young noble, and he expresses his passionate devotion to Cornwall and the Celtic culture of his forebears, declaring that all who defend it are, quote, sons of the Western afterglow. Inspiring words by Will Lloyd, set to music by his son, George. And today on the podcast, which is the second part of two, we are going to talk further to William Lloyd, George Lloyd's nephew, who was for many years the composer's business manager and close confidant. Clearly, from the collaboration on the opera Jähnen, we know that George was very close to his father and shared many of his interests. William, perhaps you could tell us a bit about their relationship and how the father influenced son's musical and intellectual development.
Well, it was a critical relationship, probably the most significant of his life, apart from that with his wife, Nancy. As we know, George was born in 1913, and in 1914 his father went to France and was in the trenches for the next 4 years. When he came back, he was badly damaged, and he threw himself into the social scene and the art scene in St Ives. And when his son emerged as a precocious talent, I think it was very significant for Will, because he had something to focus on, he was positive, he was moving forward, he had a bit of money behind him. He was always worried about money, curiously, even though they had this small estate, he was always worrying about money, because he bought and sold houses, and he was ill. When he came back from the war, he had a bit of a breakdown and left his wife and family and took off to Snowdonia into a broken down old cottage. And then that didn't work out, and he came back to his family. And his father was a bit chaotic after the war. But then when the boy emerged as a precocious talent, it focused his mind and he gave him all the support he could. In particular, he gave him a financial allowance. He paid for his schooling, and up until when George was 20, 21, it was clear that he was going places. He'd had three symphonies, and they'd all been broadcast by the BBC before he was 21. And Will then gave the rest of his life pretty much to furthering his son's development and his career. So he supported him financially. He encouraged him. George wrote three operas, and Will wrote the words, the libretto, for all those three. And in all of them, Ian and we don't know so much with the correspondence, but for the second opera, The Serf, and the third opera, John Sockman, there are dozens and dozens of letters between father and son as collaborators. You need a bit of extra music here, and I like that, and I think that needs a bit extra work. And they were very, very close collaborators. And in particular, 1947-48, he came back to England, and at that point his father was a member of the board of trustees or board of governors. He was a director of Grand Opera Productions, which was the management company for the Carl Rosa Company. Now, how Will got himself onto the board of Grand Opera Productions, I have no idea. But partly because of that position, he was able to move George into the centre stage when it came to talking about the Festival of Britain commissions. And the Carl Rosa was commissioned to produce an opera by George Lloyd. Now, his father was responsible for that, there's no doubt. While George was recovering his mental and physical stability, his father was agitating in London to get the boy's commission, and then to get it done. He tried to get it at Covent Garden, and he was quite Machiavellian in his manoeuvrings. He wanted to promise Edith Firmage the lead role in John Sockman, which was a Festival of Britain opera. It was a big deal, but he couldn't promise it because it wasn't in his gift. So there's a lot of letters about our best way is to get Enid Firmage, because she was on the board at Covent Garden. I think she was a big wheel at Covent Garden. So there's a lot of political stuff going on, and Will did all that. George was just doing the writing, and Will did the money, and he did the politics. So it was very important. In particular, he died a week or two after John Sockman was first produced. He'd been ill for some time, he had heart trouble. He died. He'd been ill, but it was an unexpected death, and that hit George very hard. Also, the production of Sockman was a disaster for various reasons. Basically, the conductor wouldn't talk to the producer, and there was an extraordinary amount of politics going on between the Arts Council on the one hand, Grand Opera Productions on the other, and the Carl Rosa and all the venues. It was a Machiavellian nightmare, and it just wiped George out. And then his father, who'd been carrying the main burden of all that, died. The opera, George swore he would never go into an opera house again because of what he was put through with that production, and with the loss of his father, it knocked him out again. So the relationship with his father was critical, generally positive. There is some sense that various people tried to encourage George to get a different librettist, because Will's style of writing was very old-fashioned, really. It was definitely old-fashioned. By the 1930s, it was old-fashioned. Some of it jars today. So thee and thou were quite common. Well,
a bit Shakespearean.
This rather romantic, archaic use of language deliberately, it kind of gave it a certain gravitas. But that was his natural language. All his poetry is full of thees and thous. He was grounded in romantic vocabulary, and that didn't suit the times. It didn't suit the times in the 30s, and it certainly didn't suit the times in the 50s. So with hindsight, you could have said that George might have abandoned him and collaborated with somebody else. But he was completely loyal to his father. There's a sense that his father was pushing him to achieve things that the father hadn't been able to achieve. So you might say that the father was holding him back, but without his father, he would have got nowhere near where he did get.
But their first big collaboration, obviously, in the public domain, was Yernin. What do we know about how that came about?
It came about because they were living in London. George was at his studies, and they lived in Upper Norwood. And from time to time, Walter Barnes, who was the founder conductor of the Penzance Orchestra, would come to London, and he'd stay with Will at the Grove, which was the name of their house in Upper Norwood, and they'd go to the opera. And they went to the opera, and they came back to the house, and over their cigars and their late night whiskey, they were lamenting how there was no opera in English. Now, by this time, it was seen that George was an up-and-coming composer. He'd had his three symphonies written and conducted by himself, by big orchestras. And Will, by this time, was known as a writer. He'd published several books of poetry. He'd written his biography of Bellini. He knew about opera. Presumably, Walter Barnes knew that he could write drama. So Walter Barnes said, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal. If you and your son George write an opera, I will produce it. And Will nearly bit his hand off. Right, you're on. So he went away, and Will, according to George, wrote the whole libretto in about 3 weeks, which is quite extraordinary, really, ready to go with very minor changes, and gave it to George. And George, they were then living in Cornwall. They had the house at Upper Norwood, but they had still had the little cottage in Zeno, which is basically two up, two down, and he moved into the old mill and hardly came out until the opera was finished. And he went upon the moors and had his inspiration and worked at it, and it just flowed, it just appeared, and it was put on in Penzance. And his mother and father both played in the orchestra. His mother taught the soloist and the chorus of their parts. Hilda Quick, who was a well-known local artist, designed all the sets, and Walter Barnes conducted, and everybody took part, and it was a great success. And
so was it a community production in a
more
way?
More or less, oh yes,
and,
yes.
And largely amateur?
No, I think they had a professional producer. Hilda Quick was a professional designer. Walter Barnes was full-time conductor, though an amateur, he was full-time. They did a professional producer, I think. I'm not sure. I think they probably had professional soloists. I'm pretty sure they would have done. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think they had professional soloists. But certainly all the chorus and all the scenery, they spent days painting the scenery in the true amateur dramatic society production. It was a community effort. But by good fortune, the music critic of the Times, Frank Howes, was on holiday in St Ives. And he went along and he wrote the most extraordinarily good review. He said, this is a revelation. He'd never seen anything like it ever on the English stage. This was a wonderful piece of work from a boy who'd come from nowhere. And because of that review and all the stir of interest that it created, Will and Walter Barnes and one or two others got together and they formed a company called the New English Opera Company. And they hired the Lyceum Theatre. And they moved it to London. And there they had professional director, Sidney Russell, and George conducted. Hilda Quick did the costume to the sets as before. But they put it on, and it had a very long run in comparative terms. In those days, there were no tourists in London. It was just Londoners who went to the opera. And it ran for 3 weeks. And it would have run longer because it was such a success. But there was a heat wave, 1934. And because of the heat wave, nobody was going to the theatre, and all the theatres closed, including George's opera, Ianin. So it came to an end. But it made his mark. Everybody came to see it. Vaughan Williams came to see it. John Ireland came several times. There was definite stir in the air over this opera from this young man who came from nowhere.
Yeah. I wonder if you could very briefly summarise the plot.
The scene opens on the moors next to a stone circle. The Nine Maidens, and the legend of the Nine Maidens is that a group of fairies were seen dancing on the Sabbath with mortal men, and as punishment for their sin they were turned to stone. And at the opening of the opera, one of the stones comes to life and a fairy, the heroine Ianin, emerges, and not long after she emerges, the hero Geraint and his sidekick Edern appear, and Geraint is about to be married to Cunaida, and the marriage is about to happen, but at the time they are being threatened, there's a battle imminent with the Saxons who are invading. Cornwall was invaded by the Saxons. It's set about 950 Anno Domini, so that was the point at which the Saxons were indeed defeating the Cornish, the last independent vestige of independent Cornwall. So he's got a marriage coming up and he's got a big battle to fight. Suddenly he sees Ianin and she sees him, and it's love at first sight. And that's the end of Act One. The rest of the opera really is the tussle between love and duty. He wants to call off his marriage to Cunaida, which causes severe problems. He wants to run away and not fight the Saxons, which is devastating for his community because he's their boss, their leader. But eventually he goes back, abandons his true love, and goes back to his family, and Ianin goes back and turns back into stone. It's basically a very conservative opera. It favours the status quo. It means you can't give up your class and your wealth and your position and your promises and your dependence for the sake of your passionate heart, even though you are in love with a beautiful fairy. And that's a classic romantic love story, which comes to a, it's not a tragic end, but it's not satisfactory for either of them, but the fates have decreed that's how it is.
Yes, and it seems to be a common theme in the Lloyd operas, this tension between duty and love, And also the idea that the status quo is threatened by an outside invader. It's in, I think, in the Cirth, it's the Normans threatening the Saxons. In this opera, it's the Saxons threatening the Celts. So there's a kind of common theme there that the conservative forces are being threatened by some outside invader, and that seems to also reflect George's general attitude to culture. That you resist the radicals and the revolutionaries, and you have to protect what's already there.
There's something in that, although I think that's, as far as musicology is concerned, yes, George was a believer in tradition. He didn't like the avant-garde modernist styles, serialism, aleatorics or chance music, new technology. He didn't find that moved his heart. He loved to hear the sound of the tenor soaring above the orchestra, as he put it. So he was a traditionalist in that sense, a conservative. Although he did study it fairly carefully, and he did experiment. I mean, there's a curious little cheeky bit of writing in one of his symphonies, Symphony No. 10. There's one chord which has all 12 notes of the chromatic scale, and that was a joke at the expense of some of his critics, saying, "Oh, I can do this, but you didn't even notice I can do that." So he was conservative, but I think there are other significant aspects in the subject matter and that, let us say, conservative outcome of the operas, because his father, although he was raised and his early life until he was 20 something was, let's say, liberal arts, adventurous, creative, he then went to fight in the war, and some of his war poetry is pretty harrowing stuff. He was well aware that on the one hand they had to fight, and they had to fight in the most brutal, horrific conditions, and the consequences of that fight were carnage on a huge scale, but it was worth it. One of his poems is saying, "It's worth it, it's worth it." I know that I found a typescript of a copy of a poem by Stanhope Forbes, who was a friend, a painter at St Ives School. His son was killed in 1916, not far away from where Will was serving on the front line. And there's a wonderful line in there to say he considered that death was worth dying for the company of the men that he had fought with. Now, that is a romantic idea, but it's also a very common idea among military men, soldiers, fighters, who get killed and blown up and lose their limbs and end up burned and destroyed and damaged. They do have this bond and this kinship. Now, and they tend, not always, but they tend to be conservative. They're fighting for queen and country. They're fighting for their loved ones at home. They're fighting to preserve the status quo against an invading force. And that's what Will did, and that's what George did when he went to the convoys. He didn't like it, the fact that he had paid such a high price for his conservative values of fighting for king and country and defending his family and so on. So it's a big subject, but yes, their work was conservative, both in the idiom, the musical idiom, and in the outcomes, the plot. They were in favour of the status quo against the wild fairy woman from the hills.
Yes, you've got two tensions there of chaos, haven't you? On the one hand, the fairy world brings its own kind of chaos of magic and enchantment and daydreams. But at the other end, you've got the chaos of war and invasion and radical change. And the conservative naturally wants to hold that middle position and say, well, we just want to keep some sense of order in our lives, and that means holding what we know.
That's right, and that's one reason he would reject the Cabaret Voltaire. He rejected absurdist literature, nonsense rhyme, random notes, writing to a formula. He just, it makes a horrible sound. I'm not interested in that. So,
but of course, it put George very much on the outside of the musical establishment, particularly after the Second World War. So ironically, by being a conservative, he ended up being the outsider. Well, Yeannon was clearly a big hit in London, and it ran for 3 weeks, as you said. It would have run for longer, but for the weather. Can you explain a bit more about the work's success and what the critics liked about it and why the public responded so well to it?
The reviews tended to focus on the staging, the theatricality of it, the drama. Now, that was largely to do with the plot and the romance. It was just a good story, a good tale, and this conflict of love and duty we were talking about was well played out, and it came to this conclusion. So the drama, they liked. One of the critics said, George Lloyd has an instinctive grasp of what the stage requires. Mm. So it was entertainment. It was entertainment in the grand opera tradition of the Italian grand opera. You've got to entertain the crowds in front of you. You've got to give them something that they want to hear. So it was entertainment, good entertainment. It worked as a dramatic piece. Musically, it allowed, because it was unusual, and it was written in English in an Italian style. The idea of giving the singers their big tune, the action just stops in order to give the singers their chance to do these great arias. Never mind about the plot too much. Give them a chance to sing, because people love to hear a great singer. So it gave them the chance to do that. It was in that style, grand opera style.
So it was appealing to emotions and senses rather than intellect and philosophizing.
Very much. I think it gave people a frisson. A number of people said that when they heard it, they had the hair on the neck. You know, it lifted them out. It was a very emotional experience. And I think it's emotional truth which was a big part of his success. And interesting that George believed that it was emotional truth which led to its creation. It was coming from something inside him which was true and real. It was a real feeling, and that communicated to the audience, and he was then able to engender that same truth in the audience. There was something about the way it was written. I think because it was written in a flood without too much tearing it apart and putting it together and analysis, it just came out more or less whole. I think that was a significant part of his success.
So in some ways his lack of experience actually helped him, because he didn't know how difficult it was meant to be. It was
exactly.
He just did it without thinking about it too
and
much.
Because he valued emotional truth above theoretical construct, he didn't analyse it. This is it. Take it or leave it. Yeah. And as it happened, people loved it.
But also, the story of the prodigy from the provinces coming to London and making a big splash, isn't that also part of what makes it exciting for the public as well? Because he is a new genius in town, and he's come from the far remote corners. And
exactly,
it's a story in itself.
He was only 21. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing.
He conducted it.
And then 2 years later, he conducted at Covent Garden. And it was unprecedented, really, to have a young man that age, that experience, to have an opera done at Covent Garden, conducted himself, written himself, in control of the production to a large extent. He was a celebrity. And as we know, doors open for celebrities.
Yes. And I suppose, but for the Second World War and the impact that had on him, what might have become of him as an opera composer? I mean, he did go on and write another opera, but as you say, somehow the steam had gone out of it, perhaps.
Well, he didn't do himself any favours. You know, he was a bit of an awkward customer, particularly after the war, when his health was extremely fragile. He was volatile. He suffered from PTSD, as we now call it, shell shock, as it was then. He saw 17 of his best friends drowned in oil in front of his eyes, and he was the last man out. And that was immensely psychologically damaging to him. Part of that, he took oil into his lungs, so it took a long time to recover. So he was, after that, a bit cantankerous, although charming when you meet him. But
he lost his innocence in some ways, hadn't he that
had
experience.
But even before the war, for example, he was approached after Ian, he was approached by John Christie at Glyndebourne, and said, "Would you like to come to join us at Glyndebourne, where you can learn to write and you can produce a masterpiece for me?" And George wrote back saying, "No, thank you, Mr. Christie." More or less, he said, "If you think I can produce a masterpiece to order, you obviously don't know anything about opera." Which was not what you say to John Christie at Glyndebourne. So he turned him down. Now, he later realised that was arrogant, but he believed that John Christie had got it wrong. Why? You can't. Basically, Christie was saying, you have to learn You have to learn about scene changes, and you have to learn about how the operas are managed and all the people that go into it. Now you work with designers and all this. She said, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is learn how to write an opera. You can sort that out. That's not for me. That's mm-hmm. your problem. Mm-hmm. I don't need to come and waste my time doing that. I'm going to write another opera. So there's a certain independence of mind which did get in the way, and I think it harmed his prospects, because the other thing is, whether he would have got anywhere, he said, Albert Sammons, he said, oh, Albert Sammons, he taught me a lot of things, Albert Sammons. One thing he taught me, he says, don't have anything to do with mafias. And he'd always had an independent streak of mind. He hadn't followed the crowd. He hadn't done what he was expected to do in order to advance himself. He did exactly as he wanted. Mm-hmm. And that meant that he was sometimes on the outside. He was independent, and he paid a price for independence.
And that seems to reflect a lot of his Cornish background and the sort of stubborn independence of the Far West. Interesting.
Because also, of course, he spent 20 years as a market gardener. After his father died and he vowed never to go into an opera house again, he went and he built up a very successful market garden business, initially growing vegetables and then moving on to carnations and then moving on to mushrooms. And it was a successful business. He was getting the best prices at the Covent Garden auctions because of the quality of his produce. So he was very, very practical, and he didn't take kindly to being patronised or disdained by elites who just didn't happen to like his style. He just ignored them. Mm. Get on with your own work. Mm. That's what his philosophy.
Presumably after 1945, Yernan was something way out of fashion. We had the modernist revolution. We had the wilder extremes of serial music and avant-gardism. So a fairy opera in the romantic style wasn't going to fit with that very well.
No, exactly not. I mean, the romantic idea was out of the window by 1930 in the upper echelons of academia, particular music criticism. It was already, the modernist idea had already taken over by then at BBC, took a while to come to fruition, but the main shifts in aesthetics had taken place. Among the public, not so. They stuck with it. The public didn't mind these and thous, actually. It was only the critics. Mm-hmm. The heroic story, the grand romance, the public loved that.
And the tension between love and duty remains current in every age. It's
exactly.
Universal, isn't it?
It's still going on.
Yeah. And how did Yernan come back to the stage in more recent times? I mean, has it had performances? Are people interested in it?
Well, it was recorded by the BBC in, I think, the early 90s, produced by Chris D'Souza, and they did the whole opera.
And that was a studio.
It was a studio performance and the recording. Mm-hmm. And then we, George and I, licensed the recording, and we issued it as a triple CD under license. So the BBC did it, and then in George's centenary year,
2013.
It was done again. It was done, Opera Company. And that was very good. Jonathan Butcher conducted, organised it. One lovely company, really lovely people, sort of semi-professional, a lot of professionals involved, but also relying on the efforts of a load of supporters. And that was successful. It was lovely for me to hear it live, because I'd never heard it live. So it's not gone yet. Whether we'll ever see it at one of the big opera houses remains to be seen.
Yes. And as George got older, and he lived to a ripe old age, we know that, what was his attitude to Cornwall and Cornish culture and the music of his youth? Well, I mean, what was his attitude to that?
Well, he did feel very much that he belonged in Cornwall, but he knew that for the life of a professional composer, it's London or nothing, really. You've got to be in London. You've got to be there. You've got to be going, hearing the young players, the young musicians. You hear something, you've got to be there. You can't be a week away or travelling up in a few days. You've got to go and hear. You've got to listen. You've got to hear conductors. You've got to hear musicians. You've got to be doing the deals. You've got to be talking to publishers and radio presenters and producers, and you've got to be there. But also, Cornwall was rather damp. He said Cornwall was damp. But whenever I go to Cornwall, I think it's lovely and warm and sunny, but he said Cornwall was damp, didn't suit him. He was invited to become a bard of the Cornish Gorseth, which is a great honour, and he recognised it as a very great honour, but he felt obliged to decline, so he turned it down. And the reasons he gave were basically he didn't have time. By the time he was offered, he was well into his 70s. He had commissions stretching well ahead. He knew his time was limited because he had heart problems, and he was extremely disciplined worker. He had a very, very regimented routine of concentrated work on his scores, then slightly less concentrated work doing his business correspondence, and then he'd sleep and go for a walk, and then in the afternoon he'd do slightly lighter work of proofreading or binding scores and various things. So he was not willing to give up his precious time in order to do the necessary duties of a Cornish bard. And I think he regretted that slightly, because it was an honour, and to decline an honour...
It appears
to be ungrateful. Yeah. But it was genuine. He just said, I haven't time. I'm not going to take this on and keep telling you no, I'm sorry. Mm. I haven't time to do it. I've got this commission to finish. My days are precious. Every day to me is a precious day to write what he had to do and record what he had to do. Mm. Because when it was clear that he was still not getting performances at the BBC, he said, right... Mm. I'm going to record everything I ever wrote. And that was when I came in, because I was in the music business, and between us we recorded everything he ever wrote, with a couple of exceptions, and that was immensely time consuming. It took 10 years, but we did it.
Yeah. Well, William, thank you very much for this two-part exploration of George Lloyd and his Cornish cultural origins. It's been a fascinating delve into the formative years of his life and work. So thank you very much, and I hope you'll come and talk to us again about other aspects of George's life.
I will. Thank you, Peter. Very interesting conversation. It's rare I get a chance to discuss some of these things which are buzzing around in my mind all the time. So I really enjoyed that, and I look forward to the next time. Thank you.
So we'll close by hearing the climax of Lloyd's Celtic opera, Yearning, that so successfully captures the unique atmosphere of Cornwall, the county of his birth. Join us next time on The Melodic Line, the official podcast of the George Lloyd Society.